Standards with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hello and welcome to Robots episode 126. I am Jana, and today's episode is all about robot standards, which are currently undergoing a major update. But first, we'd like to say a massive thank you to everyone who voted for us in the latest European Podcast Awards. The winners of the 2012 round were just announced, and we are proud to say that the Robots Podcast has been awarded the European Podcast Award in the Swiss non-profit category. So thanks to all our listeners for making this happen. And now, the robots news with Christine.
Thank you, Jana. A LEGO Mindstorms user has created a robot that can fold paper airplanes. The mini factory consists of 5 stages connected by a conveyor system. A video shows how the system first pulls in a flat sheet of paper. It then performs multiple folding operations to create an airplane, before a final stage throws the plane using a compressor. The folding robot's servo motors, touch and color sensors, and compressor are controlled by 2 NXT LEGO computers. The whole system was built from more than 6,000 LEGO parts. In other news, researchers, industry stakeholders, science fiction authors, and warfare veterans have contributed to a week-long special on Robots and Warfare on RoboHub. The special gives an overview of the types of robots used in warfare today and gives a voice to proponents and opponents of the use of UAVs in war zones. It provides a summary of what companies are developing military robots and includes expert views on the question, how will robots shape the future of warfare? Opinions range from a full endorsement of robots as tools for war to suggestions for a comprehensive ban, which highlights the complexity of the issue. For a look at the video of the LEGO paper airplane folding robot, and to learn more about robots and warfare, have a look at robohub.org.
Professor Govinda Virk currently works at the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden. His research interests include mobile robotics as well as control systems engineering and applications. But apart from his day-to-day job, he also holds a number of international posts. Since 2005, he's the chairman of the UK National BSI Standards Technical Committee. And since 2006, he is also the chairman of the ISO Technical Committee on Safety of Personal Care Robots. Our reporter pair spoke to Professor Virk about his academic career and his role in developing new standards for industrial, service and other robots, particularly personal care robots.
So, welcome to the podcast. Today I'm here at KTH in Stockholm with Govinda Virk, and we're going to talk about standards, everything about standards. So, could you introduce yourself a bit to start with to our listeners?
Yes, I can. My name is Govinda Virk. I'm a robotic engineer. I've a PhD in control engineering from Imperial College in London. And most of my life I've spent in academe in the UK, in New Zealand. And now for the last 2 years I've been in Sweden at Högskola Gävle and at 60%, and here at KTH in Stockholm, 40%. And during most of the time, I've been working in various aspects of engineering with the focus on control systems, and also different types of robotic systems. And the last 10, 15 years have been following the change in robotics, how it's changing from the traditional industrial robots to the new service type of robots, which is my main focus at the moment.
We see this trend, and of course it's obvious to everyone in the business, where robots emerge from production and come into our homes and our environments with lots more people, which has to be very challenging from a standards point of view. I guess we'll come to that a little bit later. Could you tell us why you're involved in the standards work? Why do we have standards?
For me, it started when I was in working in University of Portsmouth initially, and then University of Leeds. I was coordinating a European network of excellence. It was called CLOWER, that stands for Climbing and Walking Robots. At that time, we didn't have a service robots. What we had was we had only industrial robots. Of course, researchers were developing different types of robots, but nothing in the sense of companies and so on. And what we were trying to do at that point was how we could introduce robotic technology in so-called hazardous environments. So hazardous means people aren't there, which is the same as industrial robots. And in that way, the kind of regulations and so on that apply to industrial robots could apply to industrial robots. And the kind of things we were looking at were nuclear situations, tall buildings, petrochemical industries, you know, oil tanks and chemical tanks, and robotics for testing them, inspecting them, and cleaning them, and all sorts of things like that. So a lot of people were looking at these kind of hazardous environments. And at that time, we had something like 40 partners in CLOWER, and about 25 of them were companies, mainly small companies, but we had some big companies as well, people like Lego and STM and so on. And what these companies wanted to do at that time was they wanted to try and sell these robots that we developed for hazardous environments in sort of normal applications where there were people around. And that's when the problem sort of hit us, that we couldn't actually do that. So these companies were quite frightened to exploit the same technology that so some of them wanted to use these kind of systems for filling petrols in cars or cleaning things and airports and stuff like that, which are kind of emerging now, but at night. So you could sort of, when there was nobody about, and they wanted to do it during the day and things like that. They were simply terrified that if there was an accident of some kind, their small company would just be liquidized and liquidated and they would go out of business. And so that was about 2002 when we in CLOWER started saying, well, there's a fundamental problem here. We've got to start looking at what needs to happen. And that's when I learned about ISO and IEC and the world of standardization. And so since then, I've been intimately involved.
Because having a standard to measure against, and the company can say that our product is safe to use because it has been tested according to this ISO standard, that kind of protects them from legal action.
Well, standards normally are in kind of, they can be in different areas, and safety is one of the main ones, because if you have an ISO standard, what that means is the world, and ISO is the biggest standardization organization by a long, long way. It has over 200 countries are participating in it. So if you have an ISO standard, it'll be valid in virtually everywhere in the world. And so if you comply with that, you as a company can then safely sell your product, not just in your own country, but in all these 200 plus countries without any, well, you still have the liability as a manufacturer, but if you prove that you've complied with those standards, you are as safe as you can be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And of course, when you noticed this need, you started to involve yourself in the ISO. Could you tell us a bit about the early time there? Because I guess most of the people listening out there, they haven't done that. So they might benefit from hearing how you got into it.
Well, what happened was, in 2002, we felt there was a need. And there was two needs. One was safety. And the other was a modularization. Those are the two things we kind of went to ISO. We started saying the world is changing from a robotic point of view, and we need to do something about it. And ISO was kind of thinking about that at the time as well, but it didn't quite know how to do what had to be done. So following our kind of approach to them in 2002, it was agreed that maybe we should set up an advisory group to kind of just explore what was needed and how we should do it. And so the way it works is, generally speaking, there's a committee in ISO, it's TC184, and there's a subcommittee of the SC2, which deals with robotics. Most of the robotic standards, ISO standards, are developed by this one committee. And they discussed it, and they said, yes, there's a need, but we don't know what to do, so let's set up an advisory group. And they asked me to chair that. And it was about 2005 by then, various things. The balloting process takes a little while. All the countries have to then sort of say, yes, we think. And the way it works is there's a two-pronged strategy. So all the countries or members of this technical committee, 184, are asked, is this work needed? And so they have to say yes or no. And so the first hurdle you have to pass is it has to be a majority of the participating members. There's something like about 21 countries are interested in robotics. So you need a majority of those voting. Then, so we got that majority, and then there's a second hurdle. And the second hurdle is that at least five of those countries have to offer experts
to participate in the work.
To participate in that work item in that project. So it's normally called a project. And I think we got six or seven countries. I can't remember. But we got more than the five. So the advisory group was started, and we were simply asked, okay, you have 1 year, go away and sort of just have meetings within the, and there were about 30 partner experts were nominated from these five plus countries. So we met about, I don't know, five or six times in the year and kind of looked at robotics from every direction you can think of what was wrong or what was needed and how it was changing and what needed to be done. And we looked at the current existing standards, which only apply to industrial robots, more or less manipulators, manufacturing manipulators. Even the definition of the robot was a fixed manipulator. That was the first thing we looked at. We thought, my God, this is not, we as researchers, this is not what we think of a robot. A robot is not a manipulator only. And then coupled with that, there was a whole bunch of what is different from what's happening from the industrial robots, and we came up with a whole bunch of viewpoints, how the old robots or traditional robots, I should say, differed from the new emerging ones, and what needed to be done, and how, and it really boiled down to something like the safety was, of course, different. An industrial robot simply doesn't allow a human to be near it. You have these work cells or cages. You know, light starts flashing if the robot is moving, and the robot human is not allowed to go near it.
Or it can't even, because there's simply some form of a steel cage.
That's right. Things are changing a little bit with the latest update, but at that time there wasn't. Now industrial robots allow what's called a collaborative mode. So a human and an industrial robot can collaborate for a manufacturing task. They define a collaborative space and so on. But what was but the new service robots really needed very close human robot interaction. A robot even needed to touch a human and maybe even apply a force to do some activity. So that was kind of one of the primary things, that the safety requirements for designing a robot to be able to approach and touch a human simply didn't exist and was not allowed. So that was one of the findings. The another finding was that the type of users are going to be totally different also. Industrial robots tend to be used by trained personnel by, you know, in companies for manufacturing. So they normally have some training, so they are members of staff. And so you're going to use this robot. This is, you know, how you learn.
You can inform them about the robot's limitations.
Exactly. Whereas the new service robots could be us as robot experts, or it could be our partners without, or our grandparents or our children, who have no or limited knowledge of robotics, and they have to use it. So it becomes more like a domestic appliance than an industrial robot. And so the design philosophy has got to be quite different. So the user interfaces have to be much more natural, and you don't need to sort of have a very sophisticated code and things like that. So that needed to be different. Also, the tasks that they are going to do are going to be quite different. Manufacturing robots, of course, are flexible in, okay, one day maybe they are making metal ingots, next day maybe they are making plastic bottles, so they can be changed in the code. But in a service robot, that change could be from moment to moment. One moment you could be using the robot to do something, and the next moment it could be your child doing the same thing, and the whole process could be totally different. So that variability in the tasks will change from moment to moment, not from sort of day to day or week to week. So these were kind of the and of course new things were happening. I mentioned the robot vocabulary, you know, the term. So there were new terms coming, and so when you introduce new robot systems, the vocabulary just expands, and so that was the other thing needed updating. So after a year, we presented this this report to the sort of mother committee, and it was then agreed that, of course, the most important thing was safety, and we had to kind of the modularity kind of aspects kind of became a secondary issue, because safety, human safety, is and we said yes, that's the first thing we have to do, and that was sort of set up, and we looked at, should it be safety of robots, should it be safety of service robots, or what, and the group had really focused on that, and they had come up with a term, and they called it personal care robots, because personal care gives this kind of notion of that you're dealing with a person and you're taking care of that person, not in a kind of medical sense, but in a kind of like a shampoo or a, you know, sense that you're or soap, or you know, you're, which is not so. And but there are, of course, medical applications which came later, in fact. But the personal care implied a very close involvement between a human and a robot. And so the committee was set up, and I was also invited to lead that one, and I'm still chairing that committee to develop the safety requirement for so-called personal care robots. The work has been going on since 2006. It's reached a stage where it's almost we will go into the development stage, I guess, in a moment. But it takes a while for that process to mature and so on, for the whole international community to resonate and converge, and then only then do you have an international standard. And I can sort of tell you that that standard is almost kind of ready for publication. It's reached the so-called final draft stage, and we expect the safety standard for personal care robots to be published this August 2013.
Because then robots and humans can interact much more fundamentally closer than we have been.
Well, the rules will be made clear. Perhaps the community will have a kind of learning phase because it's quite a new standard. The industrial sort of manufacturers are only used to how they design a manufacturing or an industrial robot. Now they will see this new standard. Of course, some of the experts are involved in the group, so they know the thinking of the experts and why the clauses have been designed and so on. And I guess they will have an advantage. I can mention there is a lot of involvement from Japanese, Korean, and the last 3 or 4 years from China as well. of course, from Europe and the US too. So they, those people's directly involved know the thinking, and those companies will have an advantage. And I suspect they will be launching personal care robotic products sooner than other companies who haven't been involved.
Can you tell us a bit how the standards work progress? I mean, say that you noticed this need for a standard, and then that became a... The first thing was this...
Advisory group.
Advisory group.
Yeah.
That's just an informal group of people trying to...
No, it was still a formal group.
Okay.
But it, because it was such a new thing, ISO really didn't know what to do. So they said, all right, let's make a formal group to advise us on what we should do. And so that's why it was balloted, because the international ISO members had to kind of view it as a need. And that work, that group was given that formal task of, well, what should we do, and how, what's the priority of doing that work?
Is that the usual start of the work with such a group, or is
normally
it
when it's totally kind of a radical change from what exists already? Yes, you have to kind of do some analysis,
and then you move on. The next step, then the logical step, would be.
So at that time, in 2006, we made this report, and three groups were actually set up by ISO. Some of them had existed before and now lapsed. So there was a WG1. WG1 deals with the vocabulary.
So, and working group is,
yeah.
WG.
WG is, well, that's, sorry, yes.
So the first, the advisory group, how long did that process
run? One year.
We were given 1 year. 1 year, or?
No, we were given 1 year, but really we thought we could do it in a year, and there was a plenary meeting coming up, and you always like to report to the mother of the mother committee, so that because it's a very hierarchical system. It has to then sort of go up the chain to get the formal approval. So TC-184 was meeting, and I think it was June 2006. Feeling was, let's try and get the report ready for that, and then we can have it considered and approved. And even then, it has to be balloted, of course. So the resolution is made. Yes, we want these three new committees or work groups, WGs. So WG1 was proposed to be set up for vocabulary. WG7, which was called personal care safety. I always like to put the word robot. It's personal care safety officially, but I call it personal care robot safety because we're dealing and. And then a WG8, which was to deal with service robots. And WG8 was asked to look at the continuing need of robot standardization. And so that committee has been looking at that. So WG1 has been doing some work to how do we update the vocabulary. And in 2012, it updated the vocabulary to include a whole bunch of new terms, including a redefinition or a redefining of the word robot, which is now much, much more... I don't have it in my head, but it's much
more appropriate for the robots we're trying to build nowadays.
Yeah, it deals with things like mobility and tasks and intended tasks, and it talks about autonomy capabilities rather than being a fixed-based, reprogrammable sort of thingy, which is an arm...
How long would then this work group goes on to become a? How is the chronologically progressing then?
So work groups are set up to basically now do more detailed work, and because again the work was quite new, we were not given any projects yet. Each of the group is then allowed to develop some ideas and come up with what's called a new work item. A new work item is within ISO and even in IEC, in most standardization organizations, is time limited.
Mm-hmm. But the work group and the others,
they carry on forever.
And how long a work group usually lasts for?
As long as there's a need.
A few years to 10 years or something.
Yeah. We will carry on going until there's a need. WG7 started doing some work, as I said, in 2006. It was balloted again, you know. So now we want to set these three groups up. And, you know, again, the same process. Majority, at least five members.
So you do the bulk of the work is done in the work group, because the work item then, which is the next step, which is also balloted, I guess.
Yes. Oh, there's balloting at every stage. So so let me kind of give you the sort of maybe slightly the process of international standardization is that it's an open process. Anybody is allowed to participate, and any stakeholder is allowed to participate and contribute to the efforts and suggest changes and so on and so forth. You get open invitations and people participate in that process. So this open basis and the work processes on what's called consensus. And consensus within ISO is normally defined to be 75% of the people participating will agree and resonate with what's being proposed. So it's not 100%, because you will always get differences of opinions on, and in some cases you get some experts who have a sort of vested interest. Maybe they want to protect something, and they will try to hold things up rather than. So you get these kind of funny things happening rather than the majority who are there to promote standards and make new things happen and facilitate things. You may get some people there who say, "Oh, this may actually cause problems for me and my company," and so you as a convener are trained to spot these kind of issues and make sure that doesn't hinder the process.
But 75% is still a very qualified majority of the people participating.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And then they ballot at all these stages.
Absolutely, ballot at every point. So when a new work group is set up, they're given a remit, okay, go and develop a standard in this area. So they then, the group, we spent something like 2 years developing the safety kind of what's called a committee draft document. And it means exactly that. Nobody outside that committee really is allowed to sort of see it, because it's so rough and so initial.
Everybody should be able to talk freely without being heard too widely.
Yeah, I guess you, as a convener, you're allowed to distribute it to people who you feel is able to contribute and help it, but really it shouldn't just be distributed willy-nilly to anybody and all sundry.
Could also be a problem if somebody starts to develop a product according to that, and then there's major
early
changes.
Yeah, absolutely. This is too early.
Too much of a moving target.
Yeah, absolutely. So when now it's then up to the group to sort of see how kind of mature that committee draft is. When they feel that is mature enough, they then propose what's called a new working item, again through the hierarchy as I described, and so that work item is then accepted, and then it's again balloted and so on, and there's a call for experts made again, and the point being at that new work item, it's time limited. The group has 3 years, so if you don't, there's ways you can extend it if there's reasons and so on to 4 years. We've had to extend it because we started the work in 2008, and we are now what was it 2009, because it's going to be finished in 2013, and we've had an extension for 1 year because it was so new, and so you've got to be pretty confident at that committee draft stage that there is sufficient resonance and sufficient convergence of the international community that you'll make it in the, because no matter how hard the committee works, there are bottlenecks in the system because of this balloting process. So the first balloting is actually when the new work item is proposed. And there are normally questions, is this new work item needed? So that's a yes or no. And secondly, again, there's a majority. And then secondly, is the committee draft reasonably mature to be used as a starting point? Okay. And then, so that again, a majority of that. And then thirdly, five countries have to nominate experts again. And some countries may pull out, or a new countries may join in at that point, and new experts can be appointed. So there's that process. So then the new worker item, assuming it's all those things are satisfied, then starts, and the clock is ticking now. Okay, then you during those 3 years, or if it's extended to 4 years, you have to do what's called a draft international standard balloting. So this is called a DIS balloting. And now a DIS balloting is the first time the document is distributed to the whole world. Yeah, whole field. Now that's what's it's a draft international standard now. Before then it's a committee draft. Okay, it's only the P members and so on are allowed to see it.
And the P member are the countries.
Are the countries. Yeah.
And there's other kinds of members too.
There's O members or the observing members. So if your country has companies and so on, experts interested to develop robot systems and so on, you will be a P member, participating member. Otherwise, if you want to benefit from what's being developed, you will be an O member.
And only P members vote?
Yes. P members, well, they all vote, but the P members ones count.
Okay.
Yeah, the O members can ballot, but it doesn't sort of count. And so normally they don't bother. So the P votes are counted, and if a P member doesn't vote, it doesn't count, and it doesn't count towards. So if out of the 21, only 10 ballot, so you only need 6.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the majority
of the majority of the whole, but just the majority of the people
of the voting members. Yes. So which is the rules of the game.
But now this is distributed freely. Everybody's starting to look at it.
Yes.
The clock is still ticking.
Clock is still ticking, and at that point they have to approve or disapprove it. They say yes, and they at that point also are able to make comments on it. And there's a formal template which is they have to fill in. So it's clause X, you know, line this, and it's very, very detailed. And they actually have to propose. So they may say the definition is not very good, but they can't say improve it, you know, like this, you know, they have to say improve it in the following way. They have to give some
both problem and solution at the same time.
Otherwise it makes no sense. It's so, because you see, if you're that kind of destructive type person, you can just say this is rubbish, not acceptable, improve it, and not make any suggestion, and makes it very tough for the committee then to start, you know, well, how can we improve it, and etc. So the committee, so we get all these comments. Well, every country is allowed to make comments, and then it's up to the committee then to go back and resolve the DIS comments, and of course every comment has to be resolved, and resolved means either accepting it or not, or partially accepting it or not. And if you haven't, if the committee doesn't accept it, they have to say why not. They say this is not agreed. At the end of the day, it's the group who is in charge, and they have to, but they must address every comment. This balloting normally takes some time, because you countries have to look at it, and as national committees meet and give national, so there's a time limit taken for that. Now, in sometimes you may get a lot of comments, and because this WGC7 was quite new work, I think we had something nearly 800 comments. This was a huge work for the committee, and we felt that the standard actually had changed quite significantly, and we then said we wanted to do a second disballoting stage, which is you don't need to do, but because it's new work, we felt we should, which eats into our time, and that's why we had to actually extend our period. So we had a dis one balloting, and we had a dis two balloting. For the personal care, dis one was at that time, it wasn't dis one, it was just dis. It was approved, but with these huge number of comments. And so we as a committee decided that we should have a disk 2 because of the fundamental changes made. Because if from a disk you go to the so-called FDIS, which is the final draft, countries are not allowed to make technical comments at that FDIS stage. And we thought we wanted to allow the countries the second opportunity to make technical
comments. On comments, then, yes, basically. Yes. When we've taken in these 800 comments, right. What's your comment on that?
Yeah, because it's a huge change.
Yeah. It's and totally two different things.
Yeah, yeah. And so we had a it was an internal disballot for just the P members and even then we got, I think by memory, 612 comments at the second disballoting. And we had a meeting in Seoul last October where we met for 5 days. And the meeting was incredibly hard work to going through 612 comments. We worked from 9 o'clock to nearly 7 p.m. every day. But we had a very well-defined methodology of but these comments were much more kind of smaller and lower in terms of complexity, shall we say. And we were able to go through them in a week. I think probably is a world record for an ISO committee to go through that number in one meeting. And in November, we produced the DIS2 resolved documents. And so which means that we felt we were able to go to the FDIS. And now we are waiting for the FDIS balloting to be announced. Because what needs to happen, ISO need to take the documents we produced, translate them to, I think they need to originally they needed to translate them to French. Because we are working in English, they needed to translate them to French and to Russian in 2005. But now I'm led to believe that they are translating them to French and German. So I don't know if that's the economies are changing, and I really don't know. And that takes some time. And whether Germany wants to translate, that's up to them. But ISO normally sort of requests.
They have to allow time for that.
So definitely we'll have a French translation. Whether we have a German translation, we don't know. We're waiting for the translated documents to be made available, and then there will be a 2 month or a 3 month balloting period for the FDIS, which will only be non-technical comments.
Yeah. So, could you define the difference? There was the F comment and the...
The DIS comments are... comments normally have three different types. There's a sort of editorial type, so there's a spelling mistake or a grammatical or a typo or something. So these are editorial. Then there are something called general. It could be the structure is not good, or the approach is not so good, or it could be quite small change that maybe the title or, but they are called general, so they're not of a sort of grammatical type nature, and then there are things called technical, okay. So and the technical course are the hardest because they it's saying the safety clause is shouldn't be like this, it should be like this, and so the technical comments are the hardest, and for the FDIS, technical comments are not accepted, not allowed, because otherwise you go on forever. And
must be a hard line to draw there. Yes. What is a general comment and what is a technical comment?
That's right. And normally what happens is the ISO Central handle the FDIS comments. And because the working group fears exactly what you say, some countries are sneaky. They put in a comment which is they say is general but could be technical, and then it's the group say no, this is a technical comment. It should not be allowed, and so they normally like to see the FDIS comments and make sure that the comments are general and not technical, and that the experts, the ISO secretariat, normally aren't the experts in the field, and they could construe a comment and implement a change that a country has suggested, and it could be technical and it should not be there. So we will be reviewing what ISO. We will look at the comments and what ISO have done in resolving them and say, yeah, this is okay, or no, comment 48 is actually a technical and should not be. Yeah. So, when that happens, the FDIS comments will be resolved, and you have then an international standard, and it's published and it's available.
So then from the final draft international standard, there is a balloting process, and that makes it an international standard.
Yeah.
And is it then, what do the standards people go, do they go home and do other things, or
or
do they start to work on a revision?
Yes, it becomes a maintenance item. So the working groups, there are two jobs. So make new standards and maintain existing standards. There's a review period every, I think, 3 to 5 years. After 3 years, you look at a standard and say, is it still okay? And if it's not, you review it and you update it, and it becomes a new work item again, and so on. And during all this time, the committee is also looking at, there's this other new item that we have, which we should be looking at. And right now, my committee, WGG7, is, because it has done the development work of the standard, is now looking at, what new things need to be done to make sure personal care robot safety is now going to be okay from a implementation point of view. And I can tell you that some of the things that the group is looking at is, one of the main items is, how should manufacturers use the standard? So this is that lack of familiarity. So it's like a user's guide to it.
Ah, okay.
And so they will be...
developing that.
Huh? Yeah. So we will try to look at that, a need for that. So that would be more like an information. So that isn't a standard, but it's a different type of standard. It guides the users that this is why it's been done and this is how you use it and so on. And there may be more examples done in there. So if you were designing a robot to do like an personal care robots have been defined in three types. It's a mobile servant robot for like a domestic butler type robot to do jobs for you around the home. There's a physical assistant type of robot. This is like an exoskeleton type, or a person carrier robot. So if you want to design a person carrier type robot, you would have an example of how you would perform the risk assessment, the hazard identification, and the mitigation measures, and so on for that.
So it's kind of a support material.
Yes.
So if we have anybody still with us after all these committees, how would you say that you have two categories out there? You have a potential expert. This can be a student or a PhD or a professor, or you have a company. You have an officer of a company. I guess for the academic track, any of them are welcome to contribute. But what kind of expectations would you have of a company participating? What kind of individual would be suitable to be part of this work? Just anybody or
well, anybody interested in, I think it's from a company point of view, clearly you're in there because you want to have an influence, you want to be ahead of the game, and you want to make sure that your company's strategy then follows what's happening within the regulatory framework, because standards are used very intensively within regulation. Within Europe, for example, safety standards are so-called harmonized, which means that they are adopted across Europe to comply with EC directives, which are law, EC law. Europe has gone down this road that it has created or formulated a number of directives. There is the two directives which come very, one I'll mention first of all, is the machinery directive. A robot is a machine up to now mainly. And so there's an EC machinery directive. So any robot standard, safety standard that you develop must comply with the EC's machinery directive. So from that perspective, if it does that, it then is actually law within Europe. And several other regions like America are going down the same route, that making laws is very complicated. And if you make them once, then the standards can be much more easily updated to comply with the law. And if it's harmonized within Europe, then a company then actually has the whole of Europe as its potential market.
Yeah. So do you think that the person contributing from a company, should that be on the management level? Should be it on a technical level? I mean,
I think technical level is preferred. I think and normally also maybe from the quality side of things,
quality assurance
as well. Mm-hmm. How do you, because at the end of the day, the company will need to provide documentation that their product complies with that ISO or IEC standard, and this is how it does it. So you need to have a file on your product, which presents the risk assessment, presents the mitigation, and this is how we're complying with that standard.
Mm-hmm. If you talk about the contributions from the academic track, mm-hmm. would this be suitable for a student, or is it postgrads or professors?
Yes, I think right now, because the robotic world is changing so dramatically, the people with the expertise in the new sectors are actually the researchers. Company staff actually don't have the knowledge that we need. Normally, it is primarily industrialists who are doing it because they're trying to create something for their company. So maybe in 5 to 10 or 20 years, when the new service robotics has there will be a lower role for researchers. But right now, I think primarily it's the role of the researchers, if they are in any way interested and are motivated to help develop the area of robotics. I am a researcher. I still am a researcher. Before 2002, I didn't know anything about standardization, and I felt I had something to offer, and that's primarily what I'm doing. Because if we hadn't sort of started it, I'm not saying it would not have been done, but it would certainly have been delayed much more. The machinery that Klauer had certainly facilitated the thinking and brought a whole 30-40 people together and really did kickstart it. So individuals can make a difference, and I strongly urge anybody right now, you know, PhD, this is a perfect opportunity to become active and really contribute.
Yeah, and we'll put up some information on the podcast homepage on how you can do that. But the regular track is that you get in touch with your local standard organization.
Yes, your national member body of ISO, and now IEC is becoming quite involved as well in robot standards. They are primarily involved with things like performance measures for household type robots, things like vacuum cleaners and cleaning robots, other types of cleaning robots. The safety standards tend to be with ISO. A slight difference is for the WG7 work has grown into the area of medical robots as well, which I am convener of. It's a joint working group between most of the medical equipment work has been done under IEC, IEC Technical Committee 62. It's a huge, huge committee with, I don't know how many standards, a huge number of standards based on one mother standard, IEC 60601-1. It's a general standard, safety standard for medical electrical equipment in general practice. And when we start looking at a medical robot, this medical robot safety will heavily rely on this 60601-1, and that is being done heavily under IEC, and so that requires IEC rules. But IEC has member organizations, and so if you are interested, you should approach your ISO IEC member organization saying you're a...
And we put up some links to the main ones we know of.
Exactly.
And I guess it's You can also go to some ISO page maybe and find out the member, who would I contact in my own country.
Yes, exactly.
So we'll hope that we see the listeners out there on the trail and contribute to standards.
Yes.
Thank you for being part of the podcast.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all for today. As always, there's more information about this and all our past episodes on our website at robotspodcast.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Standards with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.